Hey fellow listeners, welcome to the Intellectual Masturbation Podcast. In today's episode, we are going to discuss Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, a film which released in the year 2004. Joining me in this discussion is a friend of mine, Namrata Menon. So, hey Namrata.
Hi Sagar.
So, with this Eternal Sunshine of Spotless Mind,
yes.
How did you discover this film, actually? Tell me about your first time watching experience of this film.
Oh, I must have watched it when I was in 8th, 9th grade, I guess, or somewhere after that.
Okay.
And like I'm 23 now, so it's been a long time since I watched it for the first time.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, I mean, at first I saw it like as a normal movie, you know, somebody has recommended or I read it on the internet somewhere, that kind of a thing.
Achha.
But I would say like the second time that I saw it after like a heavy breakup, that's when I really tried to look at it from a different perspective because I had grown up by then. And that's when some underlying hidden aspects of the movie came out surfacing and I understood some more meaning to it because 8, 9 is a very young age to watch like a movie like this, right? It feels like you're going to miss out on a lot of things.
I watched it for the first time like I think a year ago or so.
Uh-huh.
It was just, you know, like I was just trying to be a cinephile and I was like, no man, I don't need all these simple romances. Give me a complex romance.
Uh-huh.
Someone was like, watch Eternal Sunshine. And that's how I watched it. And yeah, like in my first watch, like normally people tend to complain about this film saying, you know, like they have a lot of issues. Like I've heard polarizing reviews of this film. Either they have loved it or they are like, no man, I can't watch this shit.
Mm-hmm. It's always polarizing with such films, no?
Yeah.
Like, but I like to try, you know, I try not to, you know, put it in any sort of category.
Exactly.
Like, oh my God, it's the best film or it's like the worst one.
Yeah.
Like, I like a film that can be, say, criticized a lot. Or I like a film that can have some, you know, where you can point out few good things about it and point out even the problematic things about it. Like, I want that mixture so that there's always room for doing more the next time or something on those lines. Like, you know, to get into the film of it, get to the crux of it, like it's not just, say, one-sided or it's not just, say, black and white. It's always gray in that sense.
Yeah, and the value to the discussion we are having also, it adds a lot of value to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
It just opens in a pretty chill and pretty normal manner, man. Like, you don't think so that this guy's world is turned upside down. But after a few moments when he's at the station and he's like running around the platform, you'll realize that, okay, something is wrong with this guy.
Yeah. So I would say like the film of it, since we also did a little bit of the script reading, it starts with, you know, like you said, it starts with say a one color or like a monochromatic
sphere
where it's like, it's always blue in color and it's very calm and composed. It starts like that. But suddenly we see him behave in a manner that is probably outside of character for some reason, right? And then the reason is what comes eventually in the movie where, oh, he has had stuff done to his brain and his memory and so has the other protagonist it's questioning us that, oh, it's like an open-ended film that would you do something like that or what is this complex love? That is why I think the complexity, like you said, comes in where it's not just a blanket, oh, they lived happily ever after, or it's not like, oh, they went their own ways. There's always a question at the end of the film that what did exactly happen then? Who figured it out? Did they figure it out? How did they meet at the same time? And things like that.
Also, there are little like drops of symbolism used in this film in every scene. For example, in the first scene, there is this blue bird and an orange bird.
Uh-huh.
Clementine comes up to him wearing an orange hoodie or something.
Yeah,
and like
orange,
the mood of that particular phase of their life is blue.
Yeah,
Clementine's hair is blue.
Yes,
of course. Correct. We'll not get into the hair color theories and everything.
Yeah, so, it's been done so many times, right? But I think that's the first thing that people who watch it for the first time will decipher, that the movie is the movie and the seasons are shown through the hair colors. But we can always discuss more on, like you said, color theory that the movie has used in order to showcase the feelings and seasons of the movie.
Because Clem's hair color at that point of time is blue.
Mm-hmm.
and like she's drinking, sitting on the train. She's also drinking Bombay Sapphire, which is blue in color.
Yes.
Yeah, her apartment has all these almost like a very cozy vibe when this guy gets invited over there.
Yeah.
So, like,
you were even speaking on the background score that they've used in that particular scene.
Like, you get little surprised and you get little happy when you see like your own country songs playing in the background of a Hollywood film or an English film.
Yes.
It happens many times with me, like, because there are many Hollywood films and all, someone is watching some Rajnikant scene, I instantly become like this guy Rick Dalton from Once Upon a Time and point out, look, that's Indian.
Correct.
Yeah. So in this film, like, they used in the whole sequence of them talking to each other and all, that is, I think that is what is shown as these guys' first interaction to us, right? And after this, the whole title thing comes up.
Correct.
So there are three songs which are playing in that particular time. One is like... about a woman singing about her lover and her longing for her. And another thing is Vada Na Tod, which is like in a way related a lot of ways to the climax of the film. Don't break the promise.
Yeah, I mean, as we discussed, that will also come up, how the songs were quite important for
and
that scene.
Mera Man Tera Pyasa is a very interesting song, because in this song is from the film Gambler.
Mera Man Tera Pyasa, Mera Man Tera.
And Devanand is seen like romancing an imaginary woman in his life.
Okay.
Like almost a sari and everything is tied up to a pole sort of a thing, and he's like singing and dancing around her. Quite drunk. I think Joel must be in a way in a similar state to this man.
Yeah. I mean, if you go to see throughout the first scene, we don't know whether they know each other previously or not, right? But it is showcased how they are drawn to each other, even though there are, of course, there was the empty train station and the empty coach that is there. But eventually it was because they were at the beach. Then they were at the diner together, I mean, at different tables, but they were the only one present in what we could see. And it's almost the movie wanted to show that they're drawn to each other for some reason, right? And they themselves in the conversation are trying to figure out. One is when she asks about whether you've shopped at Barnes & Noble's, and he says yes. But he's like, I would have noticed someone like you, right? Because he tries to say that, oh, why do I fall in love with every woman who shows me a little bit of affection?
Yeah.
Things like that. So they're trying to establish a scenario for the movie that maybe they know each other, maybe they don't know each other, but there's some sort of drawing that they've shown in the movie, that they're drawn to each other in some way.
And there are these little hints dropped, like Years of Relationship, just a callback to the Years of Relationship. This man tells about the Valentine's Day and saying that is the first journal entry in the 2 years.
2 years, correct.
This man is kind of worried that, you know, his life has disappeared from the journal or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Something we all are worried about. Like, you know, we are left with nothing one day.
Yeah, I mean, he says like the time goes by and we don't even realize. And even with the whole, like, you know, he's questioning that, hey, do you, you know? No, I mean, she questions him that, hey, do you know, like, don't make any jokes about my name.
Yeah.
And he's like, no, I don't know any jokes about your name. And the thing is, the first scene, even though it's establishing this movie, a lot of the answers come by the end of it.
Yeah.
You know, the first scene makes way more sense when you watch the entire movie.
In a way, this film is like some sort of a full circle journey of a couple.
Correct.
So over here, like, this man says that, you know, I'm just trying to be nice. This guy has a problem with adjectives, maybe. He uses nice for everything.
Yeah. And it's shown in, like, even Clementine's reaction of it. Like,
yeah.
Like, how much are you going to keep continuing with the word nice? And is that all you got? And And she says also that, okay, you were nice and now I'm nice all of a sudden, you know, which also much later in the movie, he says that, like you said, I'm the nicest guy that she was with.
Yeah.
And I would say, like, even the background music of the, you know, first scene, it's like very calm. And if you hear it without any visuals, you might feel like you're listening to it on a rainy day. And, you know, you're tucked in with your coffee and a warm blanket and things like that. Like, it introduces you to a very calm space where you feel like, okay, this is how a routine is for the protagonist. But eventually, when the movie takes on and we come to know that Joel has endured the period of memory erasure, that's when the music catches up with the pace of the film, where, you know, it kind of makes you also worried or, say, concerned that, oh my god, why is the, like, the process of memory erasure is happening in such a secretive manner that he falls asleep with the medicine, and that's when they enter the room and then they do it, you know, like, there's a secrecy that makes you uncomfortable. And even though he has said that, oh, I want this done, midway he realizes that, hey, maybe I don't want this done. Like, that's a constant struggle with your own mind, right? With your inner self, that
exactly.
You want this or not. Like, that is shown very well via editing, I would say.
Also, this guy is very indecisive in a way. Like, he, for the, like, starting few moments, he's unable to decide whether he should stay or he should escape and, like, go back to his... escape from his work and something like that.
Yeah.
The music, in a way, kind of... impulsive is the word he'd use to describe Clementine too.
Clementine, yeah. Correct. I know. So that's what it's like. In a way, they tried to showcase it in these character personality-wise also. That's how, like, the editing was shown in that manner, right?
Yeah.
That the music picked on. And then there's also, like, if you see, there are two lines of the movie. One is while the memory erasure is happening, and while Joel in his own mind is figuring out that the erasure is taking place. So a lot of expertise has been put on in explaining how the editing takes place or how the erasure of the memory takes place, that it is almost like a dream come true when you see the movie. I mean, that is something I've always wanted to do, you know. If I dream something, I want to know how will I put it into visuals, right?
Yeah, exactly.
This is something I think the movie becomes as close as it can. Of course, now it's all gotten better with VFX and everything. But for a movie like this to come out in, say, 2003 and 4, I was, like, quite happy with how they carried out, you know, a moment where Joel is trying to figure out whether the erasure is happening. So he realizes, like, the first scene is, the first memory that he tries to erase, they try to erase, is the one where he meets his friend.
Yeah.
Where the friend asks that, are you having any Valentine's Day plan? And the thing is, his face disappears and, you know, it kind of fades out into the background. And it's his, Joel's point of view of how he's erasing. They have tried to show it in good visual manner. And at the same time, even the difference of the scene, like I said, the two storylines, which is the erasure happening and Joel coming to know that the erasure is happening, is done by sound effects of, you know, wherever the memory erasure is taking place inside his brain, it's all vague and unclear, and there are more shadows, there are faces disappearing and things like that. So it puts you in a position of discomfort that it's happening and you have no option of stopping it.
And also, I think the success of this film lies in communicating the upside ideas it has about dreams and everything. If you look back at your dreams, and when you wake up, you don't remember anything. And in a way, this man's love story, this man's like filled with crushes and troughs, and like that kind of a journey would be just a dream, just a bad dream he'll forget next morning.
Correct.
And
the absurdity, I would say, is very clear. And one of the first things I would say is how, when Clem storms out of the house and he says, oh, this is the last time we saw, like, I saw you, it's when he kind of tries to walk to her. The lane keeps repeating, like, wherever he goes, he ends up at the car that is open, and, you know, he's like, why am I coming back at the same place? And then he takes a U-turn and again he's at the same place. So,
and the car falls down from the sky too.
yes, exactly. And that was so sudden, if you go
to. Yeah.
But it was like, oh yeah, this is real, because the dialogue immediately says that, oh, everything is falling apart. See, I'm the one. Like, his character changes to being like, oh, you know what? See, everything's falling apart because you did this first, you know? So I really felt like that is when it's established that even the most absurd ideas are brought into some sort of reality in this movie, where editing has been used in order to make people feel the same discomfort that he felt throughout the memory erasing process. And many more scenes, in fact, are later on with Patrick being, not being seen until he knows who Patrick is from the film. Lacunaing, what do we say? Clinic.
Yeah.
Then even scenes where he's in the house where Patrick is talking about you taking away clothes of Clementine. And
this man remembers the name of Patrick, but he can't figure out who he is. He is constantly asking him, who is this Patrick guy?
Yeah. And then the doctor is always there telling that, hey, I'm just an imagination. This is you. I am you. And things like that. And he realizes that there's no point telling that, oh, stop this procedure and things like that.
Yeah.
So it is like that kind of a movie which takes you along with the protagonist, you know.
Another beautiful symbolism I found over here is the lake they go to.
Mm-hmm.
The frozen lake.
Yes, Charles
River. Yeah. I feel it is there to represent the relationship they are going through in a way.
Uh-huh.
When they sleep there, and the infamous, when you imagine eternal sunshine of spotless mind, there is a poster which comes to your mind.
Yes,
yeah,
correct.
Both of them are the lake
with the crack in it, you know?
The crack is right there. It is a visual metaphor for their relationship.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, the crack is there, but that snow is not breaking yet.
Hmm.
In a way, he is trying to tell that relationships are like this, you know, walking on a lake.
Yeah.
Covered with snow, they might break and you might fall apart anytime.
Yeah, and in the first instance, I think they go in the middle of a relationship when they go to that lake. It's like you can see Joel being much more careful about the river, where is it gonna break, is it gonna crack? And then you see Clementine on the opposite end of this spectrum saying that, no, just come, and you know, nothing is gonna happen. And she's much more confident about the river there than he is, of course, because she's been there before and things like that. But the fear that he has is so high. Even when she falls, he's standing right there. He's like, oh, are you okay? The usual reaction when someone falls is like, oh my god, are you okay? But he is just stood there because his fear has taken over his want to go and pick her up or something like that. That's what I always thought. And whereas she's like, she gets hurt, but she gets up and she's like, oh my god, just come on here, nothing's gonna happen. So it's like her personality of being carefree about it kind of helped him come over to the middle of the lake.
Yeah.
Right?
In a way, she is confident and carefree, and this man is kind of insecure and introverted. If you look at the number of locks he has to his door, man, there are 3 or 4 locks.
Yes.
Even that thing adds up to it.
Correct. And I would also say one more thing is that we were discussing that there are these two type of characters that we have realized in this film, right? Say there is one, the nice guy, Joel, and then, like we were discussing, the manic pixie dream girl trope that is so heavily used in so many movies.
Yeah.
And that is something that we have to touch in this film as well, because there is underlying, I would say a lot of movies from the early 2000 eras, early 2000s started, you know, featuring this kind of...
Many romances.
Yeah, absolutely. They started featuring these character plots where, you know, there is a person like Joel who has, say, an always existential crisis that, hey, my life is so boring. My life is this, my life is that. And we have seen him come out of a relationship with someone like Naomi.
Yeah.
But, we don't know exactly who Naomi was or how it was, how their relationship was. But he again tries to mention it, how he got out of it, and then he got someone like Clementine, who's amazing and, you know, exciting, and she's the energy in the relationship, that kind of a thing. And then we have someone like Clementine, who is that energetic person who's like, oh yes, I'm going to live my... I always keep wondering whether I'm going to live my life to the fullest, and I want to take the advantage of every moment that I have.
YOLO kind of a thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's when even the judgments of a relationship come there, right? His expectation of Clementine is a lot in that aspect, because he kind of questions that, oh, are we one of those couples who are at the dinner table and we are quiet, we don't talk to each other, have dinners at outside restaurants and then go back to our lives, you know, that kind of a question. So he again has this dreadful scenario where, oh, the relationship has again become dull. which is like a natural, that which is something natural throughout a relationship. Like we always have that honeymoon phase, which shifts to something more calmer and more dull. And I wouldn't say dull exactly is the right word, but it's more calmer. It's not like the heightened, you know, phase where you're like all excited all the time.
Yeah, exactly. And over here, this man, in a way, is self-imposing like his own like previous relationships and everything, and superimposing it over the relationship he's having right now. So maybe that is another reason why they have this kind of a failed relationship. So that's it for today's episode, guys. We have lots of other things to say about this particular film, so we decided to split it into two parts. The next episode will be released soon. In the meanwhile, please do check out the other episodes we have made. We have a lot of other interesting content ranging from like films to classics to plays to literature and everything. So please do make sure you guys like listen to all those episodes. And thank you. Thank you for tuning in.